This episode is brought to you by the Women's Network.
Never just close your mind to too many things, because you just never know when that experience actually becomes, you know, the teaching moment for yourself in the future.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Redefining Ambition. I'm your host, Jamie Vinnick, founder and president of the Women's Network, the largest collegiate women's networking organization in the United States. And I'm so excited for you to meet our next guest, Kim Pegula. Kim is the president and CEO of Pegula Sports and Entertainment, the holding company that includes the Buffalo Bills and Buffalo Sabres in its portfolio. In 2014, Kim and her husband, Terry, purchased the Bills for $1.4 billion, and she made history as the first woman to serve as president of both an NFL and NHL team. Kim has been named one of the most powerful women in sports and is known for treating her players like family, which she shares more about during our conversation. In addition to all of her demanding roles, Kim has supported so many women in organizations, including TWN, which I'm really grateful for. In this episode, Kim opens up about her upbringing and humble beginnings, touching fan interactions, the importance of keeping an open mind, raising a professional athlete, leading with empathy, and more. Head to our Instagrams at Redefining Ambition and at the Women's.network and let us know what you think. Hope you enjoy the episode.
Okay, well, it is such an honor and a pleasure to have Kim Pegula on the podcast. Welcome to Redefining Ambition.
Yes. Hi, Jamie. Thank you so much for having me. Really excited to be here and sharing kind of my perspective about sports and about my life and how I got here and with all your listeners. So thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. So I have told you, I think you are incredibly inspiring. I think your story is so powerful and I'm excited for more people to learn about it. You have a really interesting background. You were an orphan in South Korea and were adopted by Canadian parents at the age of 5 years old, I believe. You came to the U.S. You were raised by two, it sounds like, amazing parents. So I would love to understand more about your upbringing, early influences, what you thought you wanted to do with your career, and how that quite literally changed your life.
Yeah. Well, there is no bigger game changer than being adopted, certainly, especially from being from South Korea, where I was, you know, in an orphanage for a short amount of time. I've been very fortunate about 3 years ago now, I was able to go back to South Korea, actually got to spend some time at the orphanage. It wasn't specifically the same building wasn't there. It was, you know, 40 plus years ago, but the orphanage is still up and running and was able to share that experience with my kids, with my father as well. It was so eye-opening and just made me appreciate where my life could have gone from being that, you know, abandoned child at such a young age to the life that I have now. So extremely blessed. And that's, you know, really been the biggest factor in my life right now, being adopted by parents that really, as you said, they were Canadian. They had two boys of their own, really didn't need to adopt. They didn't need, you know, it wasn't a situation where they couldn't have kids and wanted to adopt. It was just truly out of a calling to adopt a girl from another country. They felt like they just had more love and more to give to somebody else that was less fortunate. And I got to be that lucky person. So everything really has stemmed from there, from that point on. But growing up in Fairport, New York, I was in, I played, not many people know this, so I played the bassoon, right? Like there's not a lot of people that play the bassoon. My kids make fun of it all the time. But so I grew up, you know, in Fairport, New York. It was a huge school, like, you know, hundreds of kids in the graduating class. And I was in the marching band. And so football, my two older brothers, they were very much involved in sports, hockey, baseball. So it was always around me. And, you know, I'm dating myself, but back then we only did have one TV. We did have one TV and it only had three channels plus the PBS station, right? So of course, you know, sports was a must-see sit down. And people ask me, well, what was your favorite team growing up? And I'm always like, whoever was winning. I was one of those types of fans. I was a very bandwagon fan. So when the Dallas Cowboys back in the day were big, you know, when I was growing up, I was a Dallas Cowboys fan. When, you know, Joe Montana was a 49ers fan. So I very much adapted to kind of not the game of football itself, but all the surroundings of it. So, you know, the pageantry and the excitement and the fandom that comes with it, because I just always gravitated towards the fan, the real fan part of it growing up. So that was always kind of part of me, but I would have never envisioned like that I would be here now, you know, owning teams, professional teams, as well as, you know, being a part of their daily life and making decisions for that club. So never in my wildest dream thought of that. But when I met my husband, he was a season ticket holder for the Buffalo Sabres. He had lived in, you know, I met him in Olean, New York, which not too far from Buffalo or Rochester or Syracuse, but he was a season ticket holder. So those were a lot of date nights. We'd go to hockey games and was a fan of that as well. And of course, with my parents, you know, being Canadian and my aunts and uncles being Canadian, hockey, of course, was always on in our house. So not a stranger to the game of hockey as well. So so sports was always kind of just kind of been in the background of my life. You know, it was just always there. It was part of things we did, things that we shared with our family, very much like, you know, fans today.
Wow. Thank you for sharing all of that. So have people come back to you later in life, whether they be people from high school or even earlier than that or in college, and have said, gosh, I can't believe you're in this position. Were you someone who people would have pinned as co-owner of a major league sports team?
Yeah, you know what? I don't know. I probably not. You know, no one has said that to me directly, but I'm sure they thought that. I'm sure that there's been a lot of them that was like, oh my gosh, really? How did you get there? I'm sure that many have thought that. No one has said that to me directly, but I do think that that is a quality though, that I was able to experience, meaning that we were able to be a fan. I was able to grow up in, you know, whatever you want to call normal upbringing. And so the appreciation for where I am today, I think that's kind of what keeps myself grounded. It keeps our family grounded because, you know, this wasn't something that I grew up with. It's something that, you know, we worked towards that came unexpected and a little bit later on in our lives. So I think that kind of helps me keep things in perspective sometimes when things get crazy as it does and moves super fast in the sports world. I think that I do appreciate that aspect of growing up, quote, normal, whatever normal means.
Right, right. No, I want to get to perspective. I want to get to the stress of working in sports. In reflecting on this period of uncertainty a lot of people experience when you're graduating from high school, going off to college, graduating from college, beginning your career, were you someone who was fearful of the uncertainty? Were you someone who was perhaps more relaxed or chill or not necessarily concerned about where the future would lie ahead? And what would you tell yourself?
You know what? If you asked my parents that question, they would tell you I was all over the map. I was very much one of these, like, now, you know, to put it in the right context, you got to remember I graduated college in 91, graduated high school in 87. And in the 80s, it was very much about women power. If you remember, like, Dynasty, the TV show was really big. Women had these power suits and, you know, big shoulder pads. So there was this era of women empowerment, different from what we have today, but back then in the 80s, it was. And so, you know, I remember, you know, during my high school and college years, it was like I was going to go out and, you know, change the world. I was going to be a businesswoman. I wasn't getting married. Kids, like, that was way, way later. Like, I was raring to go. So I never had that fear and uncertainty about what am I going to do with my life. My problem probably was I wanted to do too many things and I never did anything really well, right? So like, I wanted to do this. And then 2 weeks later, I wanted to do something else. And then I wanted to do something else. And so I didn't have that certainty. And I certainly, last thing I was planning on doing was getting married young and having kids and a family. So, which is exactly what I did, right? So that's life. And I think, you know, if I was to look back on that perspective and say, you know, to help women now, I would say that, at the time I thought like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm doing all the things that I said I would never want. I didn't want to do, right? Get married young, have kids, and my career didn't, you know, really get a career going. But I would say that you just don't know where life is going to take you. And if I had been really vigilant in my quote, what I thought was going to be my path and be like, no, I'm not getting married now. Like I'm going to do this. I don't think I would be here. And I don't think there's a lot of skills that I've learned that wasn't academic or wasn't truly job related, but you know, there's so many things that you can learn from being a wife. Patience is one of them, from being a mom, you know, organizational skills. And then I worked with my husband throughout our marriage. We worked together as partners. He started the business in his oil and gas company. I have no idea about anything about oil and gas when I married him, but being a business owner, learning from him as he grew his company, me being a part of that and being a part of helping bridge that gap between family and business, I learned a lot through that. And so I wouldn't change any of that. And that's what probably I would, you know, tell others in that situation, never just close your mind to too many things, because you just never know when that experience actually becomes, you know, the teaching moment for yourself in the future.
That is great advice. And I've heard a lot of guests who come on the podcast highlight that one of the most dangerous things you can do to your career or to your life is to have tunnel vision and to be so focused on one particular thing, you lose sight of other opportunities that could come your way. So I'm really glad you touched on that. How did you meet your husband? Was it at a restaurant? You met him, started dating, and got married really young. What was the story?
Yeah, again, like I said, and I got to remember back then we did not have cell phones. So I know I'm really dating myself, but so, relationships were a little bit harder sometimes, you know, but I met him at a restaurant where I was actually, my girlfriend and I were actually applying for a job. So she and I had were a month away from graduating, and we were going to go to Alaska because we had heard that in Alaska, that where women were few, that you could get a really good job that paid really well, working in like in the different fish hatcheries or something. Now, granted, you asked me if I was, you know, if I was worried about graduation, I told you I was not. I was ready to move to Alaska. So my girlfriend and I had this big plan. We were going to go there and we were going to save a bunch of money, you know, work there for a summer, save a bunch of money, and then go to Washington, D.C. That's where we wanted to live. Well, as like I said, you know, good thing I didn't follow that path. So actually my girlfriend and I then ended up deciding to stay in town and was actually looking for a job. And I met him there actually just the first time. He was there with some of his colleagues at work at lunch. And I remember thinking like, oh, like it's awfully long lunch. Like, you know, like, does he even work? Like, you know, like you're at lunch for 3 hours. And then met again, probably after I graduated, several months later. So like I said, I actually was interviewing for a different job at a local TV station there. And then he offered me a job as well. And, you know, sometimes, you know, I was 21, believe it or not. He had was divorced, had two kids. So everyone back then thought I was crazy, but you know, I look back on it now and I think I really had some great set of parents. My parents have been married for, oh my goodness, almost 60 years now. So they've been married for a long time. They're such great examples. And I think back then, of course, they were a little bit nervous about me at a young age. But I think that upbringing really helped me know and understand, felt like he was the right person for me. And we, you know, we're on 28 years now. So, so far so good. And we've been truly, you know, real partners ever since.
And your daughter just got married last week.
Yes. Yeah, she did. She did. So hoping to keep the tradition alive.
Yes. Wow. What an insane story. So that's another theme that I love talking about in this podcast is making decisions, being decisive with them, and blocking out external noise. And that can be related to your personal life and a professional capacity. It sounds like there were certainly external factors and noises that might have prevented something from happening, but you got married at a really young age. You ended up having children. So what do the next couple of years look like?
Yeah. So part of that was really about that balance. So as I said, you know, my husband owned his own business at the time. It was a much smaller business. When he and I got married, I had two stepkids as well. So they had two stepkids plus three kids before I was 30. So a lot of juggling, but as any business owner will tell you, you wear a lot of hats. You know, you are not only the CEO, you're not only the owner, but you know, you are doing a multitude of things. You're the CMO, you're the accountant, you're a lot of these things. And so really that part of my life when my kids were growing, sometimes I go in the office, sometimes I would stay home. It was about helping in any area. So we talk about, I didn't focus on one specific area. You know, I was focusing early on when we didn't have kids, investor relations. So he would get investors to invest in some of his programs. And so I would help with that because that was the area. But then as we had kids and things transitioned, then, you know, whether or not I would do everything from charting graphs for him to cleaning out the garbage baskets to doing tax returns. It was when you're a business owner, your personal life and your business life sometimes merge together and there's a lot of gray area. So I like to think that I really worked and learned and trained in that gray area as well for many, many years. But I also got to see my husband grow his business. I saw him, you know, being a, you know, business owner, the things that were his leadership style. And so I did get to learn a lot. And, you know, as husbands and wives that work together, it's 24/7, right? So like sometimes the middle of the night, you're talking about business versus, you know, it's not a 9-to-5 job. So I learned a lot of things along the way that I don't know that I would have learned in a traditional setting, maybe as if I had a different 9-to-5 job separate from the marriage and the family. But we moved a lot too. So that we moved a lot. And then of course, our daughter, my oldest daughter, Jessie, she started wanting to become a professional tennis player. And so we changed our lifestyle as well for that. We moved, instead of being in Pittsburgh or Buffalo, we were originally in Buffalo. She was born there. We moved to Pittsburgh, then we moved to South Carolina and then on to Florida, but mainly so that she could train and continue her, you know, her career in tennis.
Wow. By the way, listeners, Jessie Pegula, world-ranked tennis player, extremely successful at the sport and very, very accomplished. So I want to fast forward a little bit. You have this really great quote you gave in a previous interview, and you talked about being 50% owner. And a lot of people you mentioned took you seriously, treated you like an owner, not like the wife of the owner. It being a part of seeing this business and seeing Terry become more successful, seeing the business grow, did you experience a shift in treatment from people, feeling like the person on the sidelines, feeling like more invisible, or just the wife to someone who is a true owner? How did that take shape?
Yeah, we had bought the Buffalo Sabres, the hockey team, first. So, you know, we were, I think, more of a traditional owner at that time. We had team presidents, we had GMs and coaches, of course. And so we came in and out. And I think we were what most people would think ownership does, kind of come in, they kind of just are big picture and, you know, you get the perks that you do from an ownership standpoint. And then when we ended up buying the Buffalo Bills, I remember my husband saying to me, like, okay, yeah, we have hockey. We do have some experience in professional sports, but the NFL is a bigger, you know, it's a little bigger animal and can't do it all ourselves. And he said to me, I just remember him saying to me, like, we can't do this deal, meaning when we were talking about bidding on the team, without your complete buy-in. He was saying that to me. And I, you know, I was all in on it. And I remember, you know, we were having this conversation with our accountants and with, you know, with our lawyers in the bidding process. And they said, well, you know, how do you want the ownership to be? And the NFL has rules that you have to have at least 30% ownership to be that managing partner, as they call it. You have to have at least 30% ownership in the business, in the club. And so I'm thinking, whatever we need to do. And he's like, well, let's just do 50-50, like, you know. And it wasn't, he just said it so randomly. And I think think he did it because we have to do it together. And how does that represent? Now, I don't think he, because I didn't realize it either, that that really legitimizes your place, right? Especially in the NFL. And listen, there are owners that own 100% that you don't really see. And a lot of them are wives, which nothing bad about that. There's others that have less than that, that are active as well. But I think for me and for coming into a new league as big as the NFL is, I think people said, oh, wow. Like, okay, so 50-50, like that's meaningful, right? It's not just, you know, it's not 3%. It's not 5%. It's meaningful. And I think that did help. And of course, you know, people will have their opinion, but it's what you do afterwards. And I think then me being visible, showing up in our meetings, being part of different committees at the league level, then my transition into being the president and, you know, working on team operations on a daily basis. I think that all then added to the legitimacy. But I think that my husband having the foresight to really give ownership, even though he didn't really need to. We're married. It doesn't really matter, that kind of thing. He had the foresight, which I'm not sure he knew at the time, but I think it really helped cement like my role within the team.
And I also think it's very inspiring for a lot of young women and younger generations to see that you have a stake in this as well. And you have a voice at the table, which is exactly what I want to get to. So you are a first, you are one of the most powerful women in sport. Do you ever think about that, by the way? Is it something that you try not to give too much thought to?
Yeah, it's always weird whenever I hear that because I really don't know what that means. I will say, though, that when my husband and I first bought the team, both in hockey and in football, I was more than happy to be in the background, even though my major was communications and I thought I was going to be a newscaster someday. I thought that was kind of my calling. And so journalism and communications was my background. But then, as I said, I got married young, I had kids, I worked with my husband in his business. And so I never really practiced any of that. And so when you don't have that repetition, you kind of lose that confidence, right? So I was happy kind of being behind the scenes. But when we ended up buying the Bills, it was such a big national presence. And then, like I said, getting that kind of 50% ownership and feeling like there was an empowerment that came with that, I realized really no one can represent at the end of the day your club, your organization better than Terry and I. And I felt like I needed to kind of rip that Band-Aid off and start being the face of that. And I didn't realize when I did that, I literally, when I say rip the Band-Aid off, you could ask my folks in the PR, I'd be like, no, no, no. When they have requests come in, then finally it was just one day I was like, you know what? I just got to do it. And so I started saying yes, yes, yes. And I didn't realize until I started saying yes, that people were watching and that people, and especially women, were like, oh my gosh, like you're there already. Like I can see you in that role. I can see you in that position. And that means a lot to me. So I didn't realize, and I didn't appreciate that. I was fortunate to have a husband that always supported anything that I did as a wife, as a female, as, you know, as a mom, but I didn't realize what that meant to others, until I put myself out there. So I, like I said, I always get uncomfortable because I'm not really sure what that means, but I do think that it is important for all of us to share our own experiences and to help in any way support each other, especially in those types of industries where it's been very male dominated.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And talking about the word power and powerful person, powerful seat at the table, it's the influence, to me at least, the influence and the voice that is amplified, that has sway, that is influencing decisions and getting their points across from a different perspective than what is usually, traditionally at least, in the room. What have you noticed are some of the key differences in having this female perspective, or at least seeing things through a female lens, that have made you feel like you've either contributed or impacted the industry somehow, or have maybe been role model to a lot of younger people who have, I'm sure, mentioned to you that they've come up or been inspired by seeing representation at the top? There isn't a ton of representation at this stage today.
Yeah. You know, I think without, you know, getting into details, I think that, you know, certainly me being female is a part of who I am. So I can't separate that. So to say it's just because I'm a female, things happen or the way I approach things, it probably wouldn't be fair to say, but it's just, it is a part of who I am being female. My husband and I are very different, you know, and I'm probably why we get along so well. But some of the things that I think I like to, that I feel I bring to the table, whether it's because I'm a female, because I'm just who I am, my genetics are my experiences, is I think more globally than sometimes he does. He's, you know, when we're having conversations, I think sometimes he does think, you know, in the moment, the issue or the problem, where I'm a much more of a negotiator. I'm much more in the gray areas. My attitude towards things are different. And I find that happy medium. You know, there's been many instances where even if it's a team decision, meaning that it's something that's affecting the team on the ice or things like that, and not necessarily business, having questions about what's going on outside of just, are they the right pick? Is it their skill set? Like maybe asking questions about understanding, well, who is this person, you know, this player as a person, what's going on there in their personal life? Is there something that's happening that's affecting their game, you know, or, you know, if there is something, you know, if they have an injury, like how are we treating them through that injury to get them back? Like what's important? So there's a lot of different aspects that I think that I like to think that from myself that I like to either bring up or at least give perspective around, like I said, give credit to my husband because he includes me in all those decisions, not just related to like marketing or fan engagement, but also on, you know, the draft, on, you know, on player, you know, player issues. And I'm not saying that, believe, I don't ever think that I'm making those decisions. We certainly let those, like the GM and our coaches doing those things, but being part of the discussions when we have those discussions with them, I think has been very beneficial to the organization.
Yeah. I want to talk about your approach to motivating, supporting the teammates. And I love that you mentioned that when you look at an athlete, you're not just looking at their performance on the field, but you need to understand how they're doing off the field as well and look at them as a human being, not just the uniform that they're wearing on the field. So to you, what has been the motivating factor behind that approach, or at least what do you feel has been the impact that has made?
Well, I mean, it has to be my daughter, right? So her desire to be, I call her our first team, a first team of one. But, you know, she started playing tennis when she was 7 years old. And it, you know, it took us to South Carolina. It took us to Florida. It's taken me through many operations. It's taken me through a lot of travel, foreign countries. It has taken us raising an athlete and then seeing the things that she has gone through, I think does give you some perspective and appreciation really for a professional athlete, no matter what sport that they play. I think there's a lot of similarities across all athletes that you have to play at and be successful at a really high level. And so I think that awareness and seeing it, you know, firsthand as a parent, I think has helped me appreciate the player perspective in that. And I do it not because I think I'm going to get more out of them or whatever, but, and especially COVID has not helped at all because there's been a lot of distance with teams and even ownership. You know, last year we couldn't even, it was hard to even be connected. We couldn't do a lot of things. In football, there's so many of them. I just, you know, listen, first of all, some players don't want a relationship with the owners, right? They're like, yeah, no, I don't need, you know, others do. Hockey is a little bit easier outside of COVID because it's a smaller group of number of men. But yeah, I do think that it's important because as we look upon, you know, performance, you know, we know performance is not just one thing. I mean, it, you know, we talk about mental health, you know, we've seen this year how much mental health has become a big issue for a lot of athletes and people in the spotlight. So certainly you can't just, you know, say, okay, their value is only what they produce out on a field or on the rink. And so you see all those things really becoming a part of that. And of course, being a husband and wife team, you know, you can never discount the wife and the kids and all those other things, because they do play a factor in it. And it's, I think it's be very wrong of us to think that it doesn't, as much as when they're on, when they're, the game starts, you know, of course they want to be focused and you want them focused on the game, but that doesn't mean that they're not dealing with things in their personal lives. So if nothing else, just having an appreciation and awareness of that, I think is important from an ownership group. Mm.
So I want to get into the stress of being an owner in the world.
My gray hair. Can you see my gray hair coming out here? Like, I have some growing in. It's hard with black hair not to have gray hair showing up. And I try to get away with as much as I can before I have to color it. But yeah, stress. Let's talk about
by the way, I do not see the gray hair. Sports is filled with very, very passionate people. And it also comes with a lot of stress. I mean, particularly with COVID, I can't even imagine, has been an incredibly difficult and trying, very stressful time, not just for the business, for the players, for the employees, for the entire ecosystem. What has been the biggest eye-opening experience or kind of a pinpoint or sore point of where some of the greatest stress comes from, and how have you been able to manage that?
Yeah.
Talking about very passionate people.
Oh yes. Bill's Mafia. His passion is one of the adjectives you can use. You know, obviously there's a lot of different stressors. There's, you know, the game itself is so, you know, it's on such a big stage. It moves very fast, as we saw just in a week of sports. Like, so many things have happened that have can affect an organization, whether it's a player, a key player with an injury, or whether it's off field issues. There's just so many things that can cause all those stressors. But I think for me, one of the biggest challenges that ownership has is that we can't, is, I think it would be irresponsible for us to think in the now. You know, coaches, they want to focus on the game that's happening this week, right? And that's their role, that's their job, to get the team ready for what's going on this week. But in ownership, you have to really look at some of the really big picture, which sometimes unfortunately forces you to make decisions that may be unpopular right now. But I, you know, you try to think like, okay, but a fan doesn't have this information, so they don't know, or an employee doesn't know this. And so I think that's where you feel like you should be able to be in control all the time, but not necessarily. you're not necessarily in control. And I know on game day, I always, you know, people ask me like, what's the biggest thing? And I said, well, the fact that you think you've hired the right coach, you think you've hired the right GM, you have the right staff, feel like you have some really skilled players. But at the end of the day, when the game starts, you have no control over any of it, right? You really don't. So you have to just literally sit back like a fan, and what happens on the field or on the ice. So as much as you think you're in control, you're really not. But that's what's like great about sports, though, is that unexpected, that unknown, that change from day to day. You know, we talk about reality TV. I mean, it's truly, it's reality TV. Like, every season, just because you went far in the playoffs one year does not guarantee that you're going to do it the next year. And vice versa. One win does not mean you're going to win the Super Bowl, and winning all your games doesn't mean you're going to win the Super Bowl either, as I've, you know, learned from previous years. So it's that unexpected that's the biggest stress, but it's also kind of what makes you feel alive and what's so fun about sports.
I mean, you're also under a microscope. People are watching your every move. That is extremely stressful. And I'm sure it was a transition from a more private life beforehand. So you have, prior to this, never been a co-owner of a major football team or sports team.
Yep.
And I'm curious, has the learning curve been very steep? Have you ever thought, I don't deserve to be here? Have those thoughts ever come to mind?
Oh, definitely. Sometimes I always be like, why are these people even listening to me? Because I am not a CMO. I, you know, didn't take marketing classes in college. I went to college a long time ago. So no, definitely. There's no handbook. just because you put down dollars, a lot of dollars, but just because you put down dollars does not mean that you know exactly, you know, what to do. So there is a big learning curve, but I do think that, you know, the way I've looked at it is I am not the CMO. I'm not the finance guy. I'm not the marketing person or the manager, the director. Those are not my skill sets. What I think, you know, is my purpose and my role as president is to lead the organization and lead the culture, provide support for all those that you surround yourselves with, people that are smarter than you. I know that's something that has been talked about a lot, but I truly believe that. I don't want to be the smartest person in the room. I don't think I am the smartest person in the room. And I think that just setting up your organization in the way that I think, especially when you own it yourself, in the way that you want it to be represented, to me, that's really kind of where what my input is into this. Sure, I give my opinions on, you know, which fan engagement or which ticket offer we want to do and things like that. But truly, you have people that really are have expertise in those areas. And that's who you surround yourself with at that time. Because yes, there's a lot of days when I felt like that. I'm like, why am I doing this? Like, you know, but at the end of the day, and I think that's a little bit different than, you know, a public company or a private one that you don't own. I think there is a sense of wanting to be a part of something that you own and making sure that it's being led in that direction. And the only people that really can do that is my husband and I. Do I want to do it all the, you know, forever? No, you know, I just think though in where we are as an organization now, I think that's, you know, my role is to be active in the day-to-day.
Got it. So you shared a little bit about your upbringing and your background, and today you have a lot of influence. You are in a financial situation that is more privileged than the average person. You also have amazing children. I mean, very accomplished at a young age. How has your definition of success evolved? And I'm curious, now in the position that you're in, advice you would offer to younger people listening to this podcast who think about what it means to be successful, when, and the timeline of achieving success in a shorter period of time. How has your definition evolved?
You know, I would say, you know, it's always evolving, right? Because life moves forward. I think it always is evolving. I would say that, you know, for me, success, you know, it'd be nice to say win a Super Bowl, right? Like that would be success. But I think if we settle on one definition of it, or if I said there was an event that would say, I would be like, oh, now I found success, whether it's a money goal or whether it's a championship goal or whatever. I don't think that would be really realistic. I think, you know, success is something is more of a path and not an actual goal that is achievable at some point in time. You know, going forward, my husband grew up as a, how do you say it? His dad was a truck driver. His family worked in the coal mines. Like, you know, he was the first child to go to college. You know, the stories, he's a hitchhike to school. So, and then I grew up, as you know, adopted and from, you know, obviously not even having a family. So we came up from very, very, you know, humble beginnings. And I don't know that, and my husband started on the oil and gas business as a petroleum engineer. He loves it. He still does it to this day. He loves it. I love what I do. Don't do it for the money. And I know that sounds very easy to say with someone who does have money that, oh, you know, if you find something that you really love to do, it'll come, which, you know, but honestly, I think for him, of course, there's some luck that is involved in it. But I think our attitude early on was we didn't do it for the money or to get richer or to get enough money to do this, this, and this, or get this and that. I think right now, you know, success has not been, I think to me is more about experience, quality time, having an effect on people versus maybe back in the day, whether or not you have this car or this job or able to have, you know, certain material things, which, you know, which listen, I, they, you know, there are real things, right? They are real things that there's nothing wrong with wanting to achieve them. But I think it's more about how you get there to achieve those things than it is when you actually get that. Because once you get it, it's like, okay, now, you know, the shine wears off and now you're always looking for something else. So I think I've learned that as our lives have progressed and by all, you know, the outside measurement of what success is. And if it's in material things, certainly we have a house, you know, we live in a nice house, we drive nice cars, we own sports teams, but I will tell you the happiness isn't just based on once we've achieved those things. So I think success for me now is more about how do I spend my time with who, what effect can I have on people? You know, how do I, you know, make the world a better place. And I know that sounds very cliche-ish, but in my world or in the people I connect with, I think is, and it's a continual thing. It's not, it changes from today to tomorrow to next year to the years beyond that. I don't know if that makes sense, Jamie.
Yes, it does. I'm so okay. Good. And also I want the listeners to know that Kim has been so supportive of the Women's Network, of women's sports groups on various college campuses, specifically at Syracuse University. I mean, you've gone above and beyond to be as supportive as you can, mentoring, I'm sure, and also helping young women on these college campuses. So it goes way beyond that work and also seeps into mentorship and other involvements at, ingrained at a really young age.
Well, and I wish I had these types of resources when I was younger. It's one thing we didn't have these types of networks that you're building, Jamie. So appreciate all the things that you do as well across all the different campuses, because that's what we need in the future. I know I've dated myself many times, but that's because I'm trying to tell you guys, you know, that's where, you know, one day I'll be long gone, and what we need to do is build that pipeline, and the stronger that is, and anyway. That I feel like I can help in any way, our sport, our industry will be so much better off.
So I want to get into leadership. You are someone who has spoken about a lot of situations and environments where you've really demonstrated excellent leadership qualities and skills. And what to you are some of the most important lessons or skills that you've been able to develop or learn over the course of your life and career, and what you would want younger folks listening to this podcast to take away from that?
Yeah. I would say just from experience, it's not, sometimes people think it's easy when you're at the top, because your decision is final, that, you know, well, it's easier for you to make decisions because you're the one making the decisions and people have to follow them. But I will say it's not easy, because usually you have to make a lot of difficult decisions. And I would say to people that being true to who you are, and especially when you're in that position to have to make difficult positions, I think I had to make choices and decisions with people I've been friends with for years, people who have worked for me for the good of others and the good of the organization. And also because I felt like that was morally the right thing that I had to do. And now, you know, back then, you know, it was hard to do. Now, and people weren't doing it then, right? Either, right? Now, you know, I look around, there's, you know, other organizations that have had similar issues and dealing with that. And I'm like, oh, I'm so glad that I stuck to who I was and this, you know, the decisions that I made that I felt were right at the time, even if they were not popular, you realize, you know, how right you are or how right you were at that time, and it saved you a lot of heartache in the past. So it is, like I said, from a leadership standpoint, it is hard sometimes that everyone takes your word as absolute, but it does lend to a lot of more scrutiny and harder grappling within yourselves to do that. But the other thing that I am very big fan of is empathy in leadership. I think especially before even George Floyd, before Black Lives Matters, before, you know, a big push on diversity and inclusion, empathy to me is just one of those things that we all could be experts at. You know, if we truly want to be inclusive, having a understanding and acceptance of others having, you know, even if you don't agree with them, it's just the fact that you're accepting that they have a different point of view, you being able to share some common ground with somebody that you may not agree on 99% of the things, but like, but you can find one thing that you guys have in common or that you can agree upon, and being able to look at that instead of all the things you don't agree on. I think that's very, very much needed in today's world where there is a lot of, you know, division, where there's a lot of, you know, just, meanness in the world sometimes. I think that's one of the other things that truly a leader needs to understand and empathize with their staff in order to be able to lead an organization.
I'm so glad you touched on that. So I want to get into a quick lightning round of questions. I'm going to ask you a question. Okay. Let me know what comes to mind.
All right.
What are max two sentences? So what is a day in the life? What's an average day? What do you do?
The average day is unpredictable, not the same. it's different every single day, every single week.
Is there anything consistent that you do every day? Meditating? Is it a skincare routine?
I wish. Some days I'm dieting, some I'm dead. No, that is something I'm working on, is having a better routine. I'm working on that, but I don't have one. That's the problem. I don't have one. It's a little bit too, you know, all over the place. I'm trying to do a better job of focusing. The routine is, I do, because of COVID, and because even now some of our staff can't be together, even in our building. So we've had some staff that have worked out of the office, some that can work in half of the office, and I can't go in their half and they can't go in my half. And so I've been trying to touch base with different departments one-on-one. So I do try to do that and schedule something routinely for that. But that's hit or miss too, depending on, I don't have anything. Honestly, don't have anything that's the same thing as a speaker every day.
That was an interesting. No. What is the funniest encounter with a fan?
Funniest. You know what? So I remember when we first bought the Bills, obviously there was a lot of accolades and a lot of, you know, fanfare and a lot of things. And I remember I kept seeing whenever we were at a game, kept seeing this guy in this it was kind of like a Darth Vader suit. I don't know. It's like a superhero with this mask. And he had this big sign that said, you know, Super Terry on it. Like that he was like, it was crazy. Right. And then one day it was after a game and I saw him, he didn't see me, but I saw him and he took off this, you know, Darth Vader-ish helmet he had on. And it was this guy that was probably like, I'm going to say in his like 60s. Right. And I was like, oh my gosh. Like I was thinking it was some college kid, right? Like, you know, how they're always crazy and they're dressing up and all this stuff. So, and I was just like, oh my gosh, like it would be like my dad at the time, like dressing up in some superhero costume every game and like being out in the fans. Like I was like, and that's when made me realize like that sports, like it affects everybody. There's no like, yes, we talk about, you know, the Gen Z and we talk about different market segmentations of our fan base, but like sports really encompasses like the 5-year-old kid going to the game for the first time to make 60-year-old men do crazy things that they would never do in their day job, you know, to, I've got someone who's 97 coming to a game in Jacksonville. So it truly is the fandom. It goes across so many different age groups and backgrounds and ethnicities. And I mean, just that's what sports does. That's the best part about it. But yeah, that was crazy to see a crazy fan and then realize like he could be your father.
What are you most proud of?
Oh, I'm going to say I'm most proud of my marriage, my husband. I know I talk about him a lot, but as I said, you know, there's an 18-year difference between him and I. Got married young, have three kids. He's divorced, got two stepkids, a slew of grandkids. You know, we didn't start out owning sports teams. We started out much more humbly, and now we're here. So we've had so much change in our lives, and to be really still have that foundation and have that true partnership. I know in a world where 50% of marriages don't last, I'm truly grateful and really proud that we're at the same place we were 28 years ago, and better for it.
It's just amazing. If you could leave our listeners with one lasting piece of advice, what would that be?
I think probably what I said earlier at the beginning of the podcast about, you know, keeping your eyes wide open. You never know where opportunity is going to be. It may be behind you, in front of you, next to you. Never think that what you do is a waste, because you just never know when that experience that you thought didn't matter actually comes back. And you never know when what you do when nobody is watching, actually someone did watch. So it's just never close your eyes, never have tunnel vision, like you said, never beat yourself up about not doing the right thing because you're not where you need to be. You get there eventually. Sometimes it's just not on your own time. But you got to be open, or else, you know, opportunity is going to be knocking. You're never going to hear it if you don't have your ears open.
Kim Pagula, thank you so much for coming on this podcast.
Oh, thank you, Jamie. Thank you to all your listeners. Appreciate all the work that you do. So, and go Bills, go Sabres.
Oh, yes.
Thanks so much for listening to an episode of Redefining Ambition. If you like what you heard, please make sure to subscribe, rate us, tell your friends, and if there's anyone you think we should have on our show, let me know. Join me next Tuesday for a brand new episode of Redefining Ambition. We'll see you all then. Take care, everyone.